Hello and welcome to 10x9, where 9 people have up to 10 minutes each to tell a true story from their own life. I'm Paul Dorn, and this is the 10x9 podcast. After nourishment, shelter, and companionship, stories are the thing we need most in the world, says Philip Pullman. And we here at 10x9 couldn't agree more. And there are 3 brilliant stories on this week's podcast.
An adventure, all right. And maybe a chance for our family to do better. Pull together. Be happy.
The boys inside began screaming again, presumably in the certain expectation that I was now embarking upon ultimately futile mortal combat with a headless poltergeist.
She could go for days without seeing another adult or getting to the shops, and felt unseen and unheard by my father, who could afford to buy her a car and wouldn't.
So let's go on an African adventure, get terrified by the Beast of Belfast, and live as Queen of the Castle. 3 powerful true stories with more than their fair share of bad language, as Mum would have said, and fairly adult themes, so please be prepared. And first up is a story from Lisa Graham. She told it in Belfast Black Box in January this year when the theme was moving. It was just her second time at the Black Box mic. Take it away, Lisa.
It will be the adventure of a lifetime. My dad's words to my brothers and myself on that very ordinary day in September 1977, after presenting his new job to us and explaining what it would mean. And certainly to my 14-year-old self, a wee girl who had only ever known life in Armagh City during the worst years of the Troubles, the idea of this brand new life on the other side of the world left me in a starry-eyed daze. Africa. Malawi. Where even was it, for fuck's sake? Couldn't find it in my school atlas. And what on earth would it be like to live in such a place? An adventure, all right. And maybe a chance for our family to do better. Pull together. Be happy. Because one thing was for sure, happy we were not. Everything seemed to happen very quickly from that point. There was furniture and a car to be sold, flights to be booked, dogs to be rehomed, that was hard, new clothes to be bought for a very different climate, to say nothing of the arrangements on the other side, house, school, and we were leaving in 6 weeks. I mean, what an opportunity. We were so lucky. I should have been so proud. My dad had been appointed by the very president of the country, Kamuzu Hastings Banda, no less, to be the first headmaster of his dream school, Kamuzu Academy. The Eton of Africa, they were calling it, where the 2 brightest children from every village in the country would be given a scholarship to this English public school education, and then they would grow up to lead the country into becoming the leading light of the continent. Amazing idea, or crazy African dictator idea? Anyway, whatever. That's what we were about to be part of. And wasn't my dad a clever boy to have bagged that gig? Clever boy, yes. Overachiever in every field, yes. And oh, forgot to mention, a sharer in the disease of so many of his fellow compatriots, the curse of the isle drink. 6 weeks passed in a whirl, and it was the Friday before we were due to leave on Saturday morning. My mum had sent my brothers and myself to stay with friends in the town during that week so that she could get the house emptied and the packing finished. It was 6 o'clock, already dark, when I arrived home from the leaving party my classmates had thrown for me. I think you did that, Kay, actually, sitting over there, still friends after all these years. Ready to say goodbye to my bedroom and start the journey all the way to Blantyre, Malawi. The house, however, was eerily quiet when I walked through the gates and up to the front door. Only one light was on when I stepped into the hallway and saw my mum sitting in tears on one of 2 chairs in the living room and the local vicar sitting solemnly in the other. "What's going on, Mum? Why aren't you ready to go? Where's Dad?" "We're not going," she said. "Get changed quickly and get in the car. We're going to Bangor." "What? Bangor? Not Malawi. Bangor." No arguing. My mind is made up. We are not going to Africa. Get in the car now, she insisted, as the vicar in the chair pompously nodded his head in support and smiled sympathetically and patronisingly. I wanted to smash his face in. What had he said to her? He'd never liked my dad and his rugby-playing ways. We were bundled into the back of the car and Mum sped off towards Portadown and Belfast like a bat out of hell. I tell you, the flight of the Earls was nothing to the flight of the Brennans out of Armagh and down the M1 that night. What had happened? Well, my dad had apparently gone on one of his worst ever benders in the week that we were away from the house. Disappeared off the face of the earth, only to return on Friday afternoon a couple of hours before me and then disappear again. Mum had had no idea where he was all week, what he'd been doing, who he'd been with. When he finally rolled up, she knew it would be madness to take herself and her three children across the world with someone who was really not safe to be with. So, crying, shouting, screaming, pleading with my mother to relent and let us go to the promised land, my father chasing after us as we moved from one place to another, one relative to another, literally running out the back door while he banged on the front. Confusion, disappointment, embarrassment, fear. But my mother held her ground. We didn't go. My father flew off on his own the next day, and we set about settling into Bangor, County Down. Mum found us a house to rent, enrolled us in schools, and we began our new life in not quite such an exotic location, but new, nevertheless. We were now a family without a father, but we had moved, and life restarted, as it does at that age. I settled into my new school, got a part in the school play, and things were sort of okay. At the end of January, 3 months later, there was a surprise knock on the door. Guess who? My dad, suntanned and jovial, although freezing cold, just stepped off the plane at Aldergrove. He had arrived with every ounce of charm he could muster to persuade my mum that everything was different now. He had a house, friends, and a wonderful life just waiting for all of us, and he had miraculously stopped drinking. Absolutely, definitely, once and for all, no doubt about it, for sure, without question. He'd stopped drinking forever. Well, that's what he said. And after a number of days, that's what my mum believed. It was all good again. It was going to be fine. Back to plan A. We were off to Malawi after all. Whoopee! Except I didn't want to go now. I'd had my adventure. I'd already moved. I had my part in the school play. But flights were booked. Due to leave 2 days before that performance, by the way. And you can see that I'm not a bit bitter about that 45 years later. It was 9 o'clock the night before we were due to leave again. Mum had gone out to see her sister and Dad had popped out to get a paper. I decided to take a walk into town, can't remember why, maybe to get a last blast of nice, cold, Northern Irish January air. As I stepped out of the house and looked down the avenue, I spotted Dad at the bottom of the street in his sheepskin coat, the Irish Times tucked under his arm, and my heart dropped like a stone. I don't know if there's anyone else in this room that has ever lived with an alcoholic, but if there is, they will know that you can tell from 200 yards away if they've been drinking. And I could tell. Just a tiny change in his gait, just the way he was holding himself. Imperceptible to anyone else, but not to me. "What ho?" he said, as he walked towards me, pushed his glasses up with one hand and leaned against a lamppost with the other, the signs I knew so well. I felt the old familiar punch in the gut I had felt so many times before. I elbowed past him, numb with shock and massive responsibility, because I knew immediately that it was all utterly pointless. Nothing would be any different. There would be nothing new about the new life we were going towards. On the contrary, it would just be the same old patterns and cycles all over again that had made our lives so miserable. Lies, deceit, pretense, keeping up appearances. And what was I supposed to do with this knowledge? Tell my mum? Make a fuss? Shout and scream again? Be the one to spoil everyone's hopes? The next morning, we clicked on our seatbelts and began the exciting journey to the other side of the world. First time ever on a plane for me and my brothers. We really were moving to Africa. My dad reached for my hand across the aisle and smiled at me. I hadn't told Mum, or anyone else. Actually, I haven't told her to this very day. We soared up into the clouds, and in 12 hours' time, we would be looking out over the red earth of Malawi and the one tarmac road leading from Blantyre, in the south of the country, to Lilongwe, further north, the old capital to the new. Maybe it would be new for us too. Maybe it would be all okay. I smiled back over at Dad and felt proud. One way or the other, it would be, as he had said at the beginning, the biggest adventure of our lifetime.
What an amazing story, Lisa, with a brilliant ending. I do hope we'll make it to Malawi for another installment at some stage. Thank you so much. And you can hear Lisa's first story on podcast 293. If you're wondering what the process is for telling your story at 10x9, it's simple. Check out the themes and dates on the website and submit your story through the submissions page. I'll give you feedback and help you make it the best it can be. It doesn't matter if it's just a vague idea or a fully formed epic. Get in touch. Or you can email directly at 10x9belfast@gmail.com. That's a new email, by the way. Feel free to email me about anything. I love hearing from you. Okay, on to our next story, and it's from Fergal McGuckin. He's a regular at the Black Box, so he knew that, despite the tolerant nature of our audience, given his story features a group of teenage boys, that a health warning was required. The theme was night, and Fergal told this back in November.
Sorry, I apologise for the odd bit of bad language in this. After 40-odd years, I'm finally going to put the record straight on an enduring spooky mystery. The Legend of the Beast of Beachway. It was the early to mid-1980s, pre-mobile phones and social media, when young people still went outside and had wondrous but distinctly inadvisable adventures. We were having one of those glorious summers, but as teenagers, going to the beach with your family, building a den in the garden and jumping in a paddling pool, all while being sunburnt to a crisp, wasn't our idea of fun anymore. So, one sunny day, we decided quite spontaneously, because that's what teenage idiots do, to go camping. Nowhere very far, you understand, just through the subway under the ring road beside the estate where my mates lived, and out to the open countryside on the other side of the road. We borrowed Decky's family tent. It was a proper big family size yoke with a separate entrance porch and everything. It would easily accommodate the five of us, as well as having room to store all of our stuff. Well, when I say borrowed, we just swiped it from the garden shed, heaped it into a shopping trolley and legged it towards the underpass before we could be seen. As I've said, we didn't go anywhere exotic or particularly scenic. No spectacular snow-capped mountain vistas. Well, if you don't count the classic Cookstown backdrop of Slieve Galleon in the near distance. Certainly no hanging gardens of Babylon, and absolutely no herds of wildebeest roaming majestically across the Tyrone Drumlins. No, we not so intrepidly set up camp a mere 2 fields away from the edge of the estate, near the site of a derelict farmhouse. The land had been earmarked for a new housing development, but in the meantime, it had developed a bit of a wild and unkempt look about it, which gave us the impression of being somewhere mysterious, wild and remote. Crucially, there would also be no danger of any angry farmer descending upon us with a shotgun in hand. We had originally thought of occupying the vacant farmhouse itself for the night, but had decided against this, perhaps wisely, on the grounds that it would be way too creepy. We were, despite the outward laddish bravado, also a bunch of big Jessies, as my mate's dad would have said. So we decided to set up camp down the field a bit, near a little copse of trees. There did not appear to be any farm animals around, which meant a merciful cowpat-free patch of ground upon which to pitch our impressively large two-room tent. Once it was up, we cracked open our tray of Steiger lager cans and improvised with our shopping trolley slash tent transporter, which was now upended and used as a grill for our sausages. Steiger lager has assumed a legendary, almost mythical status amongst teenagers of the 1970s and 80s. It was the cheapest beer on the market and tasted absolutely rank until you were about three or four cans in, after which it became the amber nectar of the gods for approximately 1 or 2 hours, after which you reach the tipping point and the vomiting starts. Other brands of cheap cat's urine-esque lager are available, by the way. Anyway, with the cheap alcohol and half-cooked sausages consumed, we settled down in our ample sleeping quarters for the night. Inevitably, the chat turned to ghost stories, with a couple of us taking it in turns using the torch-lit face method for added effect, just to be sure to scare the absolute bejesus out of everyone. The boys were regaled on the legend of the headless horseman at the old graveyard on the Black Hill, and about the poltergeists doing the rounds at Spring Hill House in Moneymoor. There was a story about werewolves and even one about a mad axe-murdering farmer from Darkest Fermanagh. Now, given our proximity to the abandoned farmhouse, this was probably a tad ill-advised. Little sleep was had for hours as intermittent bouts, sudden jumping, nipping, tugging, scary voice wind-ups continued unabated. This meant that every bird squawk, creak of the tent, or rustle of leaves or branches outside was greeted with mortal terror and suspicion. We eventually dropped off to sleep through sheer drink-addled exhaustion. It wasn't until everyone was seemingly comatose that things took a sudden and dramatic turn. Jamesy was startled out of his slumber by a loud noise just outside the tent. The rest of us were soon elbowed and shaken out of our sleep too. "What the fuck was that?" exclaimed Jamesy in a terrified and trembling voice. Then the rest of us heard it too. Someone, or something, was walking around the perimeter of the tent. It was breathing heavily, and not in an identifiably human way, while making some sort of vile snorting noise and maybe even snapping its teeth. "Oh, Jesus, is that snapping teeth I hear?" exclaimed Dave. It was clearly encircling us, obviously just biding its time, waiting to pounce. The tent, although impressive, would provide scant protection against this prowling beast or fiend. "Oh, fuck," said Dave. "Maybe it's that headless boy you were going on about earlier." This prompted an incredulous stare and eye roll from me. "Really?" And induced a chorus of holy shits and fucking hells from everyone else. All while grabbing hold of each other and, rather strangely, screaming and laughing hysterically all at the same time. Eventually, when the screaming had subsided and all appeared quiet outside again, we decided that one of us would have to venture out into the night to investigate and or confront whatever or whoever was out there. But who? Dave said it was his dad's tent that we'd nicked, so he was in enough trouble already. Jamesy was now on his inhaler, so he was out. And Johnny was cocooned inside his fully zipped up sleeping bag and refusing to come out until all this shit was over. So it was me or Decky. We decided who would be the hero slash sacrificial lamb in the only reasonable manner possible in these circumstances. Rock, paper, scissors. Best of three, obviously. I lost, of course, so it was all on me. I wasn't entirely devastated, mind you, as I was bursting for a pee anyway. So out I ventured, steeling myself to confront whatever potentially demon presence awaited me. Rather worryingly, as soon as I'd crawled beyond the sanctity of the inner room into the porch area of the tent, the zipper was closed behind me in a flash. No prospect of any backup then, lads? I fumbled around frantically looking for something I could use to fend off this thing. Should I have to? I instinctively lifted Jamie's steel toe-capped boots, figuring I could lash out with them as a blunt force weapon or throw them or whatever. I took a deep breath as I unzipped the outer door of the tent. Daylight was almost breaking outside, which provided some much-needed light, but also bathed the farmhouse opposite in an unsettling, otherworldly, demonic glow. This was not particularly helpful. Momentarily, I retreated back inside, but my heaving bladder was presenting me with a genuine dilemma at this point. So I gathered myself, launching my petrified body, eyes closed, out through the opening, while giving out an almighty Viking berserker roar. The boys inside began screaming again, presumably in the certain expectation that I was now embarking upon ultimately futile mortal combat with a headless poltergeist, a werewolf, or some other unspeakable fiend. Just then, I heard a noise from behind me. I mustered the courage to pivot towards it, and I opened my eyes. I gasped in disbelief. There it was. Not 10 meters away from where I stood. Yes, the beast of Beachway Estate was a Shetland pony. A fucking Shetland pony, I declared inwardly. I just dropped Jamesy's boots where I stood and I breathed a massive sigh of relief. One of the lads then shouted, "What the hell's going on out there? Why is it so quiet? Hello? Speak to us for fuck's sake!" Of course, I figured this was far too good an opportunity to miss. So I screamed my most blood-curdling scream. I made choking noises and shouted, "No! Please, no!" Oh, aye. Send me out to fight the beast, will yous? Of course, I eventually put them out of their misery and announced that the coast was clear and that I was only messing. I finally relieved my bladder, which was now at bursting point, before heading back in to grab whatever shot eye I could still be retrieved from our night of horror. I never mentioned the pony, though, as I thought it best to leave some air of mystery in relation to the noises we'd heard during the night. The boys, therefore, were still utterly convinced that we'd been stalked by some evil demon presence. This seemed to be confirmed for them the next day when Jamesy proclaimed, "Look, there was definitely something out here last night. And whatever that was, and whoever it was, fucking pissed all over my boots."
The Beast of Belfast indeed. Thanks so much, Fergal. I really enjoyed that. See you soon. Just a quick thank you very much to all of you who have donated to 10x9 via Patreon and at our live events over the years. It really helps to keep this project going and we are so grateful. For those of you wondering, 10x9 has always been free, but unlike other free things like, say, social media, there are no catches. Just enjoy. Okay, on to our third and final story in this podcast. It was Halloween in Limavady at the Roe Valley Arts Centre when Rosaline O'Callaghan told this story. There's the odd F-bomb, of course, as you would be familiar with on this podcast, but just be warned, it also makes reference to suicide. It's a powerful story.
He'd swallowed the homesickness long enough to gather up a good job in Glasgow, a house, car, a wife and family. But my father's heart belonged to his birthplace of Birch County, Donegal. So he moved us all to Castle Hill Farm when I was 12, Brenda 9, Yvonne 8, Geoffrey 3, and Lorna 1. Mammy had been hysterical with all the packing. I was the hunter-gatherer of empty cardboard boxes from the corner shop to be crammed with plates, cups, glasses, ornaments, holy statues, all swaddled in newspaper or reluctant remnants from my Jackie magazines. She was equally deranged with all the unpacking and little help from her husband. At Castle Hill, the rooms were painted in different colours. My bedroom was the blue room at the back of the house, overlooking the farmyard and a view of Birch Castle. Set on 90 acres, we had our own orchard, and Daddy was enthusiastic about planting a vegetable garden. He commandeered me and my two younger sisters to help him plant potatoes. He dug the rows, taught us how to plant the potato seeds, and cover them with a net so the birds wouldn't get at them. We gathered blackcurrants from the hedgerows, and my mother made jam for the first time to go along with the scone bread she baked. Daddy spent hours in the fields, leaving the house in his wellies with a double-barreled shotgun to go hunting pheasants and rabbits. One day, he gave in to my entreaties to go with him. I watched him shoot a pheasant in flight. Falcon, our shiny black Labrador, trained in the intricacies of retrieval, brought the plunder to Daddy and dropped the feathered, lifeless creature at his feet. I fooled my father and myself with my stoic, non-participatory response to the avian slaughter. The rabbit was another story. Daddy showed me how to target a rabbit magnified in the gun sight and how to steady the rifle butt against my shoulder and prepare for the kickback after firing. Aim for its head. I looked at the gorgeous bunny. The opening scene of Bambi burned the back of my eyeballs. Sorely vexed about the rabbit's mummy, I couldn't pull the trigger. Aim for its head. You have it right there. I can't, Daddy. He grabbed the rifle, but this one had bolted, and he waited for another to come into view. Put your hands over your ears. Bang. Falcon scampered into the long grass and carried a rabbit to my father's feet. My father handed me a silver metal hook and tied the rabbit's feet over it and told me to carry it. I can't, Daddy. Come on now. You wanted to come hunting. Don't be a girl about it. I'll never know if I'd have been less distraught carrying a dead rabbit. But in that unfathomable valley between existence and extinction, reserved for the dying, the pellet-ridden bunny was jerking and twitching. Not wanting to further fuel my father's disgruntlement about my being a girl, I didn't fling it from me and careen screaming back to the house. I carried it in silence, my head on fire with guilt and abject pity for an upside-down dying rabbit and its poor wee eyes witnessing its blood weave a trail of doom and sorrow over dispassionate grass. There's no public path or road to the site of the silent sentinel, Burke Castle. It's on private land. The year we lived there, that land was ours. Brenda, Yvonne and I, enthralled by the transplantation from city to countryside, ascended to this fairy tale fortress, clinging to the bare strip of soil on the edge of the north side field, so as not to disturb the crops of long-awned, bearded barley billowing in the breeze. Built during the reign of Henry VIII and one in a network of castles owned by the O'Dohertys, protecting the southern edge of their Inishowen lordships. On the dazzling days when we'd no school, Burke Castle was our home. My sisters and I held tea parties for our dollies with diluted Robinson's barley water, cheese and onion crisp sandwiches, and custard creams painstakingly packed for the occasion. We sang to the ancient stones and danced among cowpats, sheep shit, rabbit droppings, bird crap, and cowpats. The keep is three-story. The 4 to 5 feet thick walls built from rough rubble have cutouts for muskets and larger openings for cannons. Two stories below ground house dungeons, barracks, and an armory. Two circular watchtowers bestow panoramic views over the surrounding countryside, overlooking Farland View and Loch Swilly. One tower had stairs in good condition, and we climbed to this top story and a small vaulted chamber where we often sat, cross-legged, covered in picnic crumbs, and waving unseen at the cars passing on the Derry to Letterkenny Road. Though we could most easily lose track of time, we assiduously acknowledged the clarion call of dusk as it darkened the sky, encroached over the fields, and hushed the birdsong. It was time to make our way to the farmhouse for dinner, time to make a hasty departure, for night might call forth the ghost. The story tells. An O'Doherty nobleman had seduced a young local girl. When she told him she was pregnant, he crassly cast all chivalry aside and refused to marry her, denying the child legitimacy and denying her protection from the fallout of the Catholic Church. On a night when the moon was full and bright, she walked to the shores of Lough Swilly and drowned herself and her unborn baby in its cold, black pitch waters. Her desolate, outraged father had crept up the turnpike staircase to the vaulted chamber to where the young man slept and stabbed him repeatedly before throwing the lifeless body from the narrow window. On nights when the moon is again full, the grief-haunted girl rises from the deep and wanders the shoreline while the swans fly from the edges of the loch to the castle's southwest tower amidst a cacophony of wailing. The patch of grass where the young man's body fell withers when the swans weep. Behind Castle Hill on the edge of the loch are the remains of an abbey or church at Grange. Its churchyard contains some of the earliest gravestones in the area, dating from the 17th century. Close by is a deep well, where Brenda, Yvonne and I would go to catch frogs, gently enticing them into empty margarine tubs, ensuring the lid was tightly closed before escorting them home to keep as pets until our mother's screams compelled their immediate removal from the house. Our home was a picture-perfect postcard of a Garden of Eden. All I can see are fields, said Mummy. Fields, fields, and more fucking fields. Your father's a bastard. He swore he'd get me a car if we moved here. I'm stuck in this godforsaken arsehole of nowhere. Nothing was within walking distance. My mother felt trapped and unutterably miserable. Come the onslaught of winter, she was like something possessed. She could use Daddy's car when he was home, but that was increasingly rare, for he loved the drink. She could go for days without seeing another adult or getting to the shops, and felt unseen and unheard by my father, who could afford to buy her a car and wouldn't. She felt adrift on Castle Hill, bereft with isolation and heart-scalded at the withholding of the promised lifeline to freedom. The clipping of her wings was a sight to behold, as were my parents' arguments, bloating in frequency and savagery. My father's long since gone, and longer still is my sister Yvonne. 33 years ago, aged 27, she ended her life. And as grief must, it did its worst, took me by the throat to Gethsemane's anguish garden for a while, before dragging me to the crucifixion of madness. And the story tells, as a story must, the moon has once again reached its resplendent peak over the Swilly, and the swans fly. The girl is wandering the harrowed edges of the lake. She casts no shadow of comfort on me following in her wake.
Rosaline, you are such a joy to have at 10x9. Thank you so much. That was amazing. And that's it for this podcast. You can keep up with all our upcoming events and themes by having a look at our website, and that is 10x9.com. The dates for 2025 are all there, mostly, along with a couple of themes to get you thinking. And when you find a theme that fits, send me your story. 10x9 is on the socials, of course. Be sure to follow us on Twitter, Facebook, and or Instagram. And I promise not to flood your feed with nonsense, just information. Our email is 10by9belfast@gmail.com. Feel free to email me. Thanks to everyone who makes 10by9 happen. The wonderful Leanne, Margaret, Chris and Cara. The lovely team at the Black Box, the best venue in Belfast. And everyone at Roe Valley. All our 10by9 audiences, of course. They really make the evening very special. A big thank you to all our storytellers, but the biggest thanks this week goes to Lisa Graham, Fergal McCookin, and Rosaline O'Callaghan. I'm Paul Doran, and I'll be back with another podcast soon. But for now, bye-bye.